This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 386 for July 21 of 2017. Classic cars at the Concours of America. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
All right, Gary, we get to do another show right now.
Indeed we do. How are you doing?
I can't wait. I'm just busting at the seams here, man. Yeah. I'm doing fantastic. How about you?
Good. I was down in Nashville earlier this week driving the Infiniti Q50 Sport. It was 95 degrees there, so coming back to 89, it was beautiful.
And we got to let everybody know that Mike Austin is joining us, and Mike's been on the show before, but I think the last time you were here, Mike, you were working at Autoblog.
The editor-in-chief of Autoblog.
That's right. Glad to be back. And now I am a digital content director at Hagerty.
Hagerty Insurance, which insures all kinds of classic cars and like. But what the hell does editor of digital content mean?
Well, so in addition to classic cars, we have a magazine and we have a website. And it's all about promoting the culture of motoring. And, you know, people own the cars. People like driving.
Yeah,
it's a bit of a change going from, you know, what's the newest thing to let's celebrate old cars. But it's more just, you know, let's celebrate driving and everything that all the joy that brings us.
Motoring. Yeah. Cool stuff.
Sounds sophisticated when you say motoring.
That's what they used to call it in the past. That's why I say it. But we also have to let everybody know that our special guest for today's show is Diane Fliss Schneider. And she's with the Concours d'Elegance of America. That's being held at St. John's in Plymouth, Michigan.
Yes.
And but for those who don't know about your show, Diane, give us a little bit of a thumbnail. What's it all about?
Thanks, John. Excited to be here. This is our 39th Concours d'Elegance of America. It started out at Meadowbrook Hall in Rochester.
And we should let everybody know Meadowbrook Hall was one of the original homes of the one of the Dodges. I can't remember which
exactly.
Dodge.
Exactly, right.
John or Horace?
Horace.
Okay.
Horace Dodge. So it was at Meadowbrook Hall for many years, and it moved to the Inn at St. John's in 2011. So many people remember us from the old Meadowbrook days. So it's nice to be at the Inn at St. John's. We have 300 collector cars from all over the world. The cars are invited to be shown at the Concours, as opposed to a lot of car shows where you just show up day of. We work all year to find the most amazing cars from around the world. So we're 15 events in 3 days. The Concours started out as a one-day car show, 15 events in 3 days.
So what are all these other events?
We start out Friday morning with the Hagerty Insurance Motoring Tour. You can sign up for that.
You mean you're actually driving around in cars?
We are. We leave from the Inn at St. John's. We drive to the collection of Larry Smith in Pontiac. We'll view his collection. And then we'll go just down the road to M1 Concourse, where they have the Champion Speedway. So we're going to do some track experiences. We're going to have a great lunch. There's going to be three people that are going to show up that are going to do some extra special things from three of the automotive companies in town. I won't say who they are right now. But Ralph Gilles is our enthusiast of the year this year at the Concours. So
you name somebody every year as the enthusiast.
As the enthusiast, and this year
it'll be
Ralph.
Boy, he cashes the check when it comes to enthusiasts for cars.
He does. He's the car guy of car guys. And, you know, he's beloved by not only the people within FCA Global, where he's the head of design, of course, but just the people when he goes to an event, you know, he's down there with the people signing their cars, signing autographs, excited about what they're driving.
He's a rock star.
Yeah, but he's not above them. You know, he's a real car guy. So we're excited to have him. He'll be on the motoring tour as well when we arrive at the M1 Concourse.
So will Mike, right?
Yeah, I'll be there. It's one of our biggest events, like one of our, you know, they call them tent poles, but, you know, we cover all of it and we're involved in it both as a sponsor and then some of the activities as well, like ride and drives. We're giving people rides in classic cars. So we have like a 64 and a half Mustang, a 69 Camaro, a Plymouth Fury. I'm forgetting the year, but and both stick and automatic. So people can, you know, even if you don't have a classic car, you can show up, be around all the activity and all that at St. John's and also take part in it.
What are you driving in the motory tour?
I'm going to drive my Alfa Romeo, weather permitting.
I took
the roof off.
Water out
I still
there.
Have to replace it. So,
it's going to be great weather. That's what you're driving.
All right.
Yeah.
So we'll come back to the Inn at St. John's about 3:30 from the motoring tour. People can either go back home or come back to the Inn at St. John's. That evening, we have Battle of the Brands by Kip Sheward Motorsports. So a lot of sports cars. It's like Cars and Coffee at night. And we got a couple of sponsors. I don't promote drinking and driving, but we'll have Tito's Vodka has an Airstream trailer on site, and Stella has their Airstream trailer on site. So we've kind of got the love of the collector car, you know, hobby with the trailers and things. So that'll be fun at the Inn at St. John's. Friday night, we have our R.M. Sotheby's Motor City Mingle charity event, and Gene Jennings is our master of ceremonies for that event and auctioneer. That's a plated dinner, beautiful dinner to benefit JDRF.
And what's so, JDRF for those who don't know?
Juvenile Diabetes Research.
Yeah. Yep, so good cause.
We should mention, so the Inn at St. John's is basically it's former seminary, and there's a hotel there, so people who are coming can stay at the hotel and
imbibe
in the Tito's vodka?
Exactly, and stay right there on property.
Right.
And people often ask, why did you move from Meadowbrook? We love the venue. I personally loved it. We wanted a venue, and one of our partners did as well, a venue with a hotel. So it only has 118 rooms, and we fill that venue and then as well as other hotels around the area.
It's a beautiful facility. There's a picture.
Yeah,
it's a beautiful facility, and it's just a great place.
The grounds are gorgeous. The ballrooms are beautiful. The people there are just amazing staff. So it's a great place to have this event. We're happy there. The community embraced us when we moved. I mean, everybody from the Chamber of Commerce to the police department to the local businesses, the Kiwanis, the Rotary. So,
and I have to hasten to add, people like Gary and I who live on this side of town, it's very convenient for us to get to it.
Yeah, the east side people are whiny because we moved, and you were happy because we moved there. So you can't make everybody happy, but it's worth a drive for people from all over. I mean, to see this many cars that are this fantastic in one place, over $90 million worth of cars on the field on Sunday.
Wow.
Just that day alone. So
you must have some special categories or special cars, too, as every car tour does.
We do.
Tell us a little bit about them. Or you know what? We've got some pictures of cars. Why don't we just bring them up?
Sure.
Or start to bring up a few, and we'll get back to some later. But Carmen, just run some pictures of cars here.
It's a quiz.
Oh.
What is it?
So it's a Mercedes Roadster. Mm-hmm. This has got to be a special concept, though, I'm guessing.
It is.
And it looks like it's probably from around 10 years ago.
There you go.
Is that right?
There it is.
Okay. So what is it exactly?
I can't tell you the model. Okay.
It's the Mercedes McLaren SLR, and this is, I think it's a Stirling Moss tribute.
You're exactly right.
And I think they built a few. They sold these, right?
That's out of Mr. Fisher's collection in Troy. So, yes, that is a Stirling Moss car, yes.
Okay, yeah, and you're right. Extremely low volume, though.
Yeah.
Very rare.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's run another picture here.
I want to see how smart you guys are.
So,
Mustang.
69 Mustang, I want to say.
These are cars that you think you might see on Woodward Dream Cruise, or you might see these at Autorama, but we have a class called Maximum Muscle. So these cars have maximum horsepower. These are the best of the best in this muscle car class.
So if I'm reading, I think I can read the sign, Boss 427.
Right.
And I want to say that's a 69 Mustang.
I'm not so good at the muscle cars. I got to be honest. It's part of my education now at Hagerty because that's the heart of what we do. But when you say maximum muscle, is that factory muscle or period correct tuning or just factory?
Okay. Yep, factory. And some of these cars are fresh restorations that have never been seen since they've been restored. So it's exciting.
These are cars from 66 to 73.
Right.
Let's bring up another one, Carmen.
You have your
Of course, look at this. Can-Am car, UOP. I want to say, didn't George Falmer race this car? And I'm trying to think of the other guy that ran it. But this was at the very tail end of the heyday of the Can-Am race series.
Yep, and we have an awesome collection of Can-Am cars coming. This is Jim Barthel's car, and he had this at our press day. And he has two cars, actually. And these cars are going to be a big draw for spectators. We've had lots of calls. People want to come and see these Can-Am cars. Some of the drivers will be there. George Levy, I don't know if you know him.
Yeah.
He's got a book that he just wrote on the Can-Am cars. He'll be there with his books, signing books and selling books.
So. This is one of the special classes this year,
exactly,
too.
Exactly. Okay. One of our featured classes, yeah.
Cool. So what are some of the other special things that you got coming at this?
We're hopping around. So Friday night, while all of us are at the Motor City Mingle, some people will be out on the parking lot at Battle of the Brands. That's fun. Sports car night. We have a little contest to see who can bring in the most cars out of one mark, and Porsche last year won. We also select a car that evening that will be on our show field on Sunday. This is something new this year. So enthusiasts can bring their cars. We'll have judges go around, and that car will be chosen to join us on the show field on Sunday.
So this would be like the Porsche Club or the Mustang Club, and they solicit their members to come to St. John's, go to the parking lot, and show off their cars, sort of like Rolling Sculpture. That was last week, no?
Yeah.
And and then a judge comes and picks.
Team of three judges will select a car, and they'll ask that owner if they can be on our show field on Sunday. If they say yes, then that car will be in a special class, has been chosen the best car for Battle of the Brands.
I can't believe anybody would say no after they...
It's pretty cool. I mean, you get... exhibitor credentials. You get to enjoy a great lunch in the Grand Ballroom, thanks to RM Sotheby's. And, yeah, it's a really nice experience.
Diane, we've already got a question in from Armand, who's watching the show right now. He asks, when do preparations start for next year? Talk a little bit about... It's got to be an enormous effort to put on a show like this.
Well, Armin, we've already begun for next year. Next year is our 40th anniversary, so preparations, actually 3 years ago, we tried to, you know, set up a 1-2-3-year plan kind of down the road, what marks we're going to feature, who our collector of the year is going to be, who our enthusiast of the year is going to be, and we've extended some of those invitations to people. So, there was a lot of moving parts, 400 volunteers, 75 vendors and sponsors, 300 cars that we have on the field on Sunday, and 15 events. So we have, Armin, begin to do this. So, and we're always looking for more enthusiasts who want to help us do this. So,
where do you find the cars? I mean, 300 is a ton. Like, you know, you could go out there and there could be somebody who's never been in a Concours but says, hey, I have a car that, you know, it's sitting perfect. It's worthy, but, no one might know where it is.
You go to other events, but you also talk to people, and people nominate their cars because we can't know, as you know, where every car is. And sometimes you'll find something that you go, wow, how did we not know this car was 8 miles from us, for instance? So, it's just networking and getting to know people and telling people, you know, send us your nomination. We have a nomination form online. Send us a picture and the story about your car, and then our car selection committee goes through those. Brian Joseph's the head of that committee, and each one of the members of that committee has a specialty. So one is muscle cars, one is, you know, pre-war cars, the jazz age, the guy that does the drag cars and the race cars. So, and the Jet Age Juniors, Tony and Greg. So it's fun.
Yeah, no, you guys do have fun. I remember a couple of years ago you had hearses.
We did.
And, I mean, historical hearses.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite displays of any car show of any time is you had, I want to say it was 33 Indianapolis race cars. And as you started at the front of the grid, because they were lined up in rows of three, just like they do at the start of the race, you started at, I want to say, damn near 1911, and as you moved farther back in the field, it was newer and newer and newer cars. And it was just a brilliant way of seeing the evolution of Indianapolis race cars at one time, at one place. So when you say you have fun with it, I can tell you I love the way that you guys approach it.
Thank you. Yeah, and it's because of the talent of our team. I mean, I don't do this alone. You know, if we have to have these people on our team that have the connections and that know these cars and that choose these categories. And then, like Dave Gutierrez, who went out and found all these Can-Am cars and rallied these people around. And he's got a, also, Dave put together a whole group of non-flip top funny cars. And if you guys grew up in the Detroit area, you know Shavoom is one of those cars. Maynard Rupp will be there. Al Bergler, who did all the tin. Angelo Giapetroni, remember Gratiot Auto Supply?
Oh, yeah.
Ange will be there. So Jay Howell. So the whole group will be there, so it's a reunion. And I won't say what birthday he just had, but Al just celebrated one of those decade birthdays, and I know Angelo's, you know, up there. So to me, this is personal to have these guys there, and this is history. And, you know, to take pictures and have them be there with the cars. It's not just the cars going down the field, but it's, you know, it's capturing their experience and having people talk to them while they're there. So that's going to be a very cool car.
Yeah. It's interesting, and the breadth of the Can-Am and then the funny cars. I mean, it's
yeah,
just like...
it's just like night and day.
Yeah.
But two extremes, but something that you wouldn't normally see at a Concours. Maybe we'll have a cackle fest. You know, we'll start those cars up and let them roar, and we'll have some of them come through. We don't pull any of our cars through typically with a golf cart. They have to start to go, you know, down our line. But I think when people come, we'll have some non-Concours experiences like that. That'll be fun.
Okay, we got to take a quick break right now. We'll come back, and maybe you can explain what a Cackle Fest is, but right now we're going to give a shout-out to our friends at BorgWarner.
BorgWarner, developing advanced technologies specifically aimed at reducing emissions, increasing fuel economy, and improving performance. Our award-winning innovations extend from turbocharging and cooling systems to friction materials and diesel cold start technology. Built on a century-long reputation of innovation and reliability, we have the track record that proves our technology can help meet the challenges of the commercial truck and off-highway industry.
Okay, we're back. We're talking with Diane Schneider all about the St. John's Concours d'Elegance of America. And as I was saying, for those who don't know, what is a Cackle Fest?
Start those motors up and let them run.
Well, you're talking to the dragsters.
Hit the motors on those dragsters and let them run and hit the throttle and
start
let them
all
cackle.
Up at the same
start
time. Let them cackle.
Start them and let them cackle.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I found interesting is that, you know, you were talking about Ralph Gilles earlier from FCA, and so he's bringing a dozen cars, and it's going to be Form Follows Passion. So it's all the way from a 57 Alfa Romeo Zagato to, and I'm sure this will make people very excited, he'll have a Dodge Demon there. So I think a lot of people will come just to see the Demon. And so, I mean, you were saying Ralph is very enthusiastic about this stuff. So clearly he's reaching out to his colleagues at FCA and say, hey, let's bring in some cool cars that we've designed over the years.
Yeah, and it's those cars he chose himself. Some of them he owns personally, but they all have a place, and there are storyboards that go with each of them that tell the story of why he chose those particular cars. Either he worked on them at FCA during his career, or they're cars he owns, or cars he's just really, really fond of, and that's like his dream car kind of thing. So the Alfa Zagato, the 57, is on display right now inside the lobby at the Inn at St. John's, which is pretty cool. You walk in, and that's a car that Ralph drove in the Mille Miglia. So that's a fun story. He'll be there to tell these stories and talk to people about them.
Mm-hmm. They're four Vipers, so I guess he's a little biased toward that car.
He is the father of one of the generations of Vipers, and that's another thing we have going on Saturday. We have a seminar sponsored by Bosch, and it's at 10:15, and they have the five generations of Vipers. We'll have them in the grand ballroom, and five fathers of those generations of Vipers. So Roy Sober all the way through, you know, Dick
Ralph.
Winkle. Yeah.
Herb
yeah.
Helbig.
Yeah, Helbig. Yeah. I'm going to see if you guys know all the five
he'll,
fathers.
He'll
if we skip
all.
One, you guys.
He'll know them.
I've been looking at it. I've been studying at home.
Don Fernandez. See? We can't leave Don out. So.
Oh, wow. I remember
yeah.
Don.
So you guys can't forget. Then we got them all in there. So that is going to be, since they're ceasing Viper production next mm-hmm. month, this is kind of a farewell send-off. There are transmission people coming, engine people coming. It's a Viper reunion. At the same time, we have the Viper seminar going on. We have Cars and Coffee. LBI Limited is sponsoring Cars and Coffee out front at the Inn. M1 Concourse just announced their car and driver, Cars and Coffee, is coming to be with LBI. And we're a little nervous. We've talked to the police because there were 2,182 cars at Cars and Coffee at M1 a few weeks ago. So Bring it on. We're ready. You know, we want the more the merrier. But we'll have front row parking for Vipers. We have a lot of Viper Club people coming for the seminar. So, yes, Ralph is bringing a few Vipers that defined his career.
Mm-hmm. In the Kronos concept, you remember that car? From
I'd have 98? To see the picture.
Oh, it was one of the last beautiful cars that we could get Trevor Creed worked on.
Uh-huh.
And you know what it is.
I'm sure I would recognize. In fact, Carmen, you got some more pictures there? Let's take a look at some more cars.
Kronos.
Okay. It's a Ferrari. What is it, Mike?
That's a LaFerrari.
Okay.
LaFerrari, Ken Lingenfelter's LaFerrari. We have a class called Hypercars. So while Brembo goes 60 to 0 in 3 seconds, these cars go 0 to 60 in 3 seconds or less. So the Tesla, so that's going to be fun. I mean, I don't care what it is. If it's red and sporty, people love it, especially young people. So Ken Lingenfelter owns the LaFerrari. That'll be on our field. And with that car, he'll bring some Corvettes out of his collection as well. So that'll be fun.
Yeah.
This is this car, the Historic Vehicle Association is inducting this Blue Streak Graham into the National Registry in Washington.
Mm.
And so they're celebrating the aerodynamic styling of Amos Northup. And since the Graham was birthed in Detroit and founded in Detroit and lived here, this is a great place for them to make this announcement. They'll have a seminar on the Graham and Amos Northup's career.
That's what, about 1939, 8, somewhere in there?
30, oh my gosh, all of a sudden my mind's blank here. 30, I'm sorry, I forgot.
Yeah, I'm guessing about a 39.
You have that in your cheat sheet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, but it's a really, that grill is stunning. I mean, if you look at that, and it's like the years for these 30s cars to be this rakish, and you know, remember the shark nose Graham?
Yeah.
Oh, that is just crazy. And you look at styling now, and a lot of those cues were taken from back then. So, mm-hmm. But they're going to have a seminar on that right after lunch at 1:30. They'll do a walk-around presentation of this car and talk about that. So
you've mentioned a couple of these seminars now. That's one of the other adjuncts to the whole show.
Right.
Saturday morning or Saturday afternoon, too, I guess. You've got, I mean, these are like almost classrooms on car things.
This one, the HVA seminar, Hagerty is sponsoring that, and there will be probably 250 to 300 people in that room to listen to the seminars. And they're free, so they're no charge. They're educational, they're fun. And
I went to one a couple of years ago that was really good. That was, I think the title of the seminar was Restoration or Preservation.
Right.
And that's becoming a big thing right now. Mm-hmm. Instead of doing a chassis up restoration, as long as it's in good shape, just keep the thing running, right? Don't lose that patina of history, as they say.
Actually, we present a preservation award. We have a preservation class for non-restored cars that are pretty extraordinary. And that's in conjunction with FIVA and the Historic Vehicle Association. So, and Hagerty has one more seminar. They sponsor two seminars. Bosch sponsors two. Hagerty has a barn find seminar that kicks off the seminar series in the morning at 9 with two guys that the public loves, Wayne Carini and Tom Cotter. And everybody knows Wayne Carini from Chasing
TV
Classic
show.
Cars on TV. And then the other character is Tom Cotter, who just wrote a book on Michigan barn finds. And a lot of them were in the Detroit area. So that book's coming out, and it's going to be interesting to see what barn finds he came up with.
He hosts our Barn Find Hunters video series, too.
He does.
On the Hagerty site.
Yeah. One of our most popular.
Okay, another question. SubGR77 says, are golf carts available for the physically disabled, or can we bring our own?
That's a very good question. We have ADA-compliant buses that shuttle the people from our public parking at the Plymouth High School right to the front of our tent where people can come in. We have courtesy shuttles that will go from stop to stop to stop. Unfortunately, our insurance doesn't allow people to drive golf carts on our property, but they can bring their own Amigo or their own motorized scooter.
Mm-hmm.
But we have ADA-compliant, you know, equipment that'll get them to and from.
Okay, good.
Yeah, good question.
So there's a featured coach builder, Murphy of Pasadena. Tell us about that.
Murphy of Pasadena, those were aluminum-bodied cars. which, you know, now with the Jaguar being aluminum and the Ford F-150, everybody thinks that's such great new technology and great building, but it really wasn't. These cars, for the most part, were from the late 20s, mostly Duesenbergs and some Packards. A lot of them have really crazy stories. Keith Crane, for instance, is bringing a Duesenberg that it's Chicago cop car green. Now, I haven't seen this car physically, so what is that? And it's got a crazy story that it belonged to this barber that was part of this famous family. So you're going to have to come and read the story. Mm-hmm. And they all, a lot of them have just crazy stories, but they're exquisite aluminum body cars, lightweight for that size of a big car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what are jet age juniors?
Jet age juniors are cars like Falcon, the smaller cars that were jet agey looking and racy looking, but like a compact car. It kind of started out that whole compact car movement. Every year, Tony Hossein and Greg Cockrell on our car selection committee come up with a crazy category, and it's all the jet age. So there's a number of cars in that category that are fun.
Good stuff. Anything else you care to add here, Diane? Are we missing anything?
We're missing one seminar. The last seminar of the day, we save kind of the really gravy stuff for last sometimes, not to give less a tribute to anybody else during the day like the people I talked about. But at the end of the day in the Grand Ballroom, those Vipers are being replaced by the five cars out of the Keller Collection in Petaluma, California. And there are collectors of the year, Deborah and Arturo Keller. So they're bringing five swoopy aerodynamic cars like the Taubel Lago that you see on the screen right now or on your TV. They're beautiful. And, you know, our hopes are that people will see these cars on the field. You know, the love for 30s cars isn't there by young people. But, I mean, you think that's a hot rod that somebody built today in their, you know, in their shop. So they're cool. So David Rand is doing this.
David Rand, who used to be a GM design.
Exactly. David is doing this seminar on the aerodynamic styling and featuring the Keller cars. So that's going to be a great story. And you'll be able to see the Keller cars before Sunday and meet Deborah and Arturo, and David will do an exceptional job.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, look, we're going to have to wrap up this segment of the show. But, Diane, thanks so much for coming on and telling us all about what you're going to be doing at St. John's.
Thanks. We still have tickets available.
Now, how do people get tickets?
Yeah.
Go to our website, Concours, concoursusa.org. And there are tickets. There's all this information. We skipped Doris Jill's luncheon for Project Beautiful on Saturday. So we have a full dance card, a concorso at Saturday night. So come on out and enjoy. Thanks.
Will do. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. We're going to take a quick break right now. We're going to be coming back talking a lot more about things that we've been doing here. But right now, we're going to give a shout out to our friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back, and now it's that part of the show where Dr. Data.
Okay, so this time we're going to have a set of numbers that I want you guys to try to figure out what this set of numbers separated in time indicate. Okay. So, Carmen, please bring up the first image. Okay, so 2006, 716,268. 2016, 10 years later, 371,403.
I think I know the answer to this
one. I think you do, too, because I think I was surprised when I saw that you sort of reported on this.
Do you have a guess?
It's something to do with...
Gary always gives us a hint. There's a blurry something
Carmen
in
gives,
the back.
Carmen gives you that hint, or okay. Katie gives you that hint, or
Okay, well, looking through the blur, I would have a different guess. Just based on the number, I would guess it had something to do with sedans versus SUVs, but I think it's different than that.
It is different than that.
It's motorcycles.
Yeah, so...
Go ahead, tell the story.
Carmen, bring the... So we all thought that, you know, when we went through the Great Recession, that cars took a hit. But, I mean, look at the incredible number. This is all motorcycles sold in the United States. I mean, the number is nearly cut in half.
So in 2006, there were over 700,000 motorcycles sold in the U.S. The Great Recession came. Sales crashed. Last year, only 371,000 sold. So this is what's so interesting, and it's a great number that you brought up here, Gary, because cars crashed, but they came back. Housing prices crashed, but they came back. The economy crashed, but it came back. Motorcycle sales crashed, and they never came back.
And even more interesting, because like how cars have become super segmented, bikes have too. We've got all these, you know, different size dual purpose bikes that are more road friendly. I mean, I love the Honda Grom. Every time I see one, I want to get a motorcycle license. But there's more bikes out there, I think, and fewer sales.
Right, and you were reporting
more variety.
And you were reporting on Daily about, you know, Harley's business has just really taken it hard.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a number of things happening. These numbers, and I don't know why the hell have motorcycle sales not come back? And now Harley's got a double whammy because they rode the baby boomer boom. You know, boomers who grew up with Easy Rider, you know, Peter Fonda, the freedom of the motorcycle. I mean, they all ran out and bought Harleys. Millennials, they never grew up on that movie. Harleys don't mean nearly as much to them as it did to boomers. And so not only have motorcycle sales never come back, now Harley's losing its base of buyers.
You know, and there was, and Harley's talking about bringing out that electric motorcycle. I mean, I wonder if that'll ever see the light of day.
I'll bet it does.
Do you think it'll make any difference?
It could with millennials.
Well, millennial.
Yeah, I still claim to be in Generation X.
All right, okay. Whatever.
Yeah. But you still have the barrier of getting people onto the bike. You know, so my personal one is I need to get a license. I need to get certified. And then there's a little bit of a safety fear. But I think, you know, once you learn how to ride, that's it. But, you know, maybe compared to boomers, you already knew how to ride, and then you slowly increment all these, you know, okay, well, you got to wear a helmet now, or okay, you got to, you know, take an extra test. But you got to do it all up front now, and maybe that's intimidating.
Mm-hmm. See, and these are motorcycle numbers, and I mean, I just wonder whether there might be an increase in the number of scooters. I mean, are we going to see sort of like, you know, interurban transportation that young people are basically saying, well, you know, I can get one, you know, a Vespa, and that'll suit my needs. And if I'm going to go somewhere else, I'll call Uber.
Well, that's where I think the electric is going to make a big difference. Because, you know, for some reason, I think the perception of somebody that doesn't ride a bike or, you know, is in the inner city, they think of gas, I don't know, maybe it's dirty or they have to fill it up, you know, where the electric offers way more convenience. And then you have that situation where you can go, hey, I can park this on the sidewalk. I can, you know, I can, I don't need a garage for it. If I need to go somewhere else, I can Uber or Zipcar or Maven.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I don't know enough about motorcycle designation. You know, where's the cutoff? And you say everything from here and below is a scooter. I mean, because I've seen some Vespas that I think would absolutely qualify as motorcycles. Mm-hmm. So, and where do you say no? From here on up, it's motorcycles.
It varies state by state, but it's generally 50cc and below counts as a moped or a scooter.
Okay.
And then there's some limitations on speed, which is an interesting thing with electrics, right? Because you can make that's all electronic. You can make an electronic limit.
Right.
But it's also, in terms of the size and the compactness, you can make a little moped style thing with a lot more power than what you get out of a gas engine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and then there are a number of companies that do have electric scooters on offer now, but I mean, it's sort of, you know, like Zap and things like that, and you never hear of them or see them. I just find that to be.
One thing that fascinates me about motorcycles and bikes is, you know, on the used market, even, you know, motorcycles, you can get into them starting around $8,000 and go spend as much as you want. But when you look at what people are spending, especially millennials, spending other things on. You've got weird, or not weird, but, you know, different varieties of electric transportation, whether it's like a foot scooter or an e-bike, or just buying a really nice mountain bike or road bike. They're buying these things where you can get a second-handed scooter or a second-hand motorcycle for the same price.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some choice there where somehow people are ignoring the motorcycle as this alternative to, I can go out and have fun.
Mm-hmm. I know you're interested in mountain biking, and I was looking at a piece in, I think it was in Wired this month, that they were showing a couple of electric mountain bikes.
I've ridden one.
I mean, it's like over $7,000 for one of these, which is startling to me, but obviously I don't know what mountain bikes cost. You do. I don't.
Yeah. I mean, even $7,000's pricey, but not if it's not necessarily if it's electrified. But yeah, I got a chance last year out in West Virginia in the mountains to go out mountain biking. And you still have to pedal, but you have an electric assist, and then you can vary it. You can have minimal assist or maximum assist. I set it on minimum just to see how it would go. I could go up anything. Yeah. I mean, I could ride all day on these things, and I'm riding with all these other guys, and they're huffing and puffing and panting. And
imagine if you were on a dirt bike, though.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So speaking of electric vehicles, so there was that big rumor this week about Lucid Motors and the possibility that Ford would acquire them for Lincoln. You know, there's questions about the future of Faraday Future, because it seems to be running into some economic issues back in the home country in China. So, okay, what's going to happen to these startup EV companies, and we'll even include Tesla?
Well, remind me of the relationship between Lucid and Faraday, because they're somewhat
They're competitors. But what's so interesting about the two is there's a guy named Nick Sampson at Faraday, and there's a guy named Peter Rawlinson at Lucid, and they both design electric cars. They were both the co-chief engineers on the Tesla Model S. So they split, they found some money, they started these companies, and they both built two electric cars that, and I mean, they are aimed right at Tesla. And these are cool cars. I mean, well, these guys know what
like
they're doing.
These are like 1,000 horsepower cars, though. Well, I mean, well, they're bigger and...
Yes, you can get a 1,000 horsepower. Faraday just showed that it's, or was it Lucid? Lucid just showed that its cars can go like 245 miles an hour. But if you want to buy the base version, you know, it doesn't do that speed. You'll start out with rear drive only. I think they're saying 400 horsepower and a $60,000 price tag. But to your question, Gary, boy, I don't know. I mean, how many very high-priced electric cars can the market withstand? And you know, right around the corner, Porsche's coming to the market, Mercedes, BMW, Audi, you know, and I don't know, that's slicing the pie mighty thin.
What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Ford thing is a perfect example, especially when you look at the Silicon Valley mindset where some business are being made for exit strategy, which is, I'm not saying those guys are doing it, but, you know, eventually, you have to make money. Sometimes you make money by getting someone to buy all your ideas. But, you know, it's this classic thing where you love it because they're coming up with new ideas, because they're not entrenched in all of the, you can't do it because this, you can't do it because X, because of Y. But then when they try to make it, they run into all those roadblocks that, you know, the reason why we haven't seen traditional auto manufacturers jumping into this is because they stopped at the can't phase. So, I love the... you know, the ingenuity and the spirit of we're going to pull this off, but reality seems to be a harsher pill.
So if one of these companies, Lucid, let's say, since that it seems to be more independent and it doesn't have a big parent, because I think Peter Rawlinson's always out looking for funding for his firm. If they get absorbed by one of these companies that basically had the can't attitude to begin with, I mean... What's the likely outcome? I mean, will there be further development, or would it just basically be, yeah, we got one of those?
Well, look, I think it's like we've been talking about classic cars. Somebody gets this pile of rust. They restore it beautifully. They spend a fortune restoring it. They never get their money out of it. So now fast forward to these electric car startups. They spend all this money developing these really cool electric cars. I mean, I've been in the Faraday Future car. I was wowed. I was knocked out. I've seen the Lucid car, and I'll give you a backstory on that in a second. But I think you could buy somebody like Lucid, that a Ford Motor Company could buy a Lucid for less money than it would cost Ford Motor Company to tool up an all-electric car just like it. And the backstory I wanted to mention is when we were at CES in January, you know, that's where I got to ride in the Faraday Future car. That's where I got to do all these interviews with the people at Lucid. When we came out at the end of the day, there's this big open parking lot across the street from the convention center in Las Vegas at CES, and there was about four or five senior most level Ford executives taking test drives in the Lucid car. And I remember telling to Chip and Carmen at the time, I said, hey, look at that, all the Ford guys there. Wouldn't it be perfect for them to buy Lucid and make it part of Lincoln? So obviously Lucid had the same idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I have to, you know, pick a line, I'm going to say the odds are good that it would work out. Previously, an automaker might buy something and it just gets absorbed into, you know, all of that bureaucracy in that machine. And I think the automakers now have recognized how quickly they have to move, and they've recognized the value of having an independent division that can sort of operate outside the rules to move faster, and also, you know, hopefully transfer some of those lessons into the rest of the corporate culture.
So would this be, say, Lucid by Lincoln? Or would Lincoln offer a Lucid? You see what I'm saying? So a Lucid would be like a Continental. So yeah. You can buy a Continental, you can buy an MKZ, you could buy a Lucid. Or would Lucid be sort of a standalone Halo sort of?
I mean, why expend effort into building up the Lucid name when you already need to put more effort into building up the Lincoln name? So
all right.
Fold it in.
Yeah, no, I could argue the other side, too, just as easily saying, you know, it would inject a lot of excitement in. Here's a brand new car. It's out of the valley, Silicon Valley. It's blah, 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 blah. You know, you can only get it at Lincoln dealers. But I'm kind of with Mike, too. I think if I were doing it, I'd call it the Continental or something like that. I'd bring back one of the old Lincoln names.
All right. So to wrap this up, 5 years from now, will Lucid exist? Will Faraday Future exist? Will Tesla exist as independent standalone companies?
Only Tesla.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
And we'll see how that pans out.
Yeah. Hey, we're going to have to take a quick break in a minute. But, Mike, we got a question from Jonathan Brown. Not a question. He says, tell us more about your Alpha.
All right. Well, it's a 87 Spider Cloverleaf. And it was a friend of my parents, so it had been sitting for about 8 years. So the good news is it's only 19,000 miles.
The bad news is
it was sitting. Years. So I had to, I'm in the midst of doing everything. So I took the top off because it needed to be replaced. And then I've taken my sweet time putting the new top on. But prior to that, I did, you know, all of the belts and hoses, the engine mounts, the transmission mount. And
is this a picture of it that we got?
That's not the car, but yeah, mine looks just like that. It doesn't have the roll hoop.
Yeah,
I have different wheels. It's really fascinating because before I got it, everyone was like, you know, there's a car called the Miata, right? And it's true. This is like something like 700 pounds heavier than a first generation Miata. It's got, you know, this big heavy engine. It's more of a relaxed cruiser, but it's got this intangible. It's the reason everyone loves Alfa and loves Italian cars is it's just got this quirky beauty to it. And the mechanical beauty, too, that Alphas, I think, have a reputation for unreliability, the Giulia notwithstanding. But they're actually just high maintenance, that they run reliably. You just have to be always working on them and doing, you know, a tiny tweak here or, you know, finding a leak there.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good point. You know, if you go back certainly through the 60s, you always had to twiddle with the carburetors or something every Saturday morning, and then it ran fine for the next week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's my oldest sister has a graduate, still has it, but it was one of the first sort of like classic style cars I was ever exposed to. So I've always wanted one and now I got it.
Cool. Well, good. We're going to take a quick break. We got more to talk about, but we're going to give a shout out to our good friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back. And boy, we're getting some questions here. We've even got a couple of phone calls. Carmen, let's bring one of the phone calls in.
Hi, this is Glenn Zarovsky at Delmont, Pennsylvania. One of the reasons their motorcycle sales are falling off is back before the recession, you could buy a new Harley, drive it all summer, ride it all summer, sell it the following spring, and the only thing it cost you was the insurance because there was so much demand. Harley flooded the market with their bikes, and nobody's buying new ones every year like we used to buy them. Thank you very much. Bye.
Thanks for that insight, Clem. That's a great point. Great point. In fact,
supply.
Our work wrote in to say Vespas were hot 20 years ago and then dropped off when gas prices dropped. And after a number were killed around here, wherever he is, he says, the Vespa's good for college town environs for short hops that destroy your car.
Yeah. Well, it just seems to me that, I mean, college campuses where, for example, we just heard that the North Campus of University of Michigan will have that autonomous bus service. But I have a feeling that there would be some people who could have Vespas and go zipping around that bus and get to where they're going much quicker.
Much quicker. Except in the dead of winter, maybe.
That's true.
Hey, we got another phone call from Jonathan Brown. Let's bring that one in.
Hey, guys. It's Jonathan Brown. It's an awesome show. Good to see Mike Austin with Hagerty there. Question, why doesn't GM create a CUV for GMC based off the Chevy Bolt, since the Bolt sales seem to be at 111 days right now? I mean, it's a very efficient Euro transport, but America wants something that looks like a CUV, has all-wheel drive. Why isn't GM moving on this? Or do you think they will? Thank you very much. Have a nice day.
Thanks, Jonathan.
So you remember when the Volt first came out, Volt with a V, and they, branded the powertrain Voltec, and they were saying this is a platform, and you just assumed, okay, we're going to see variants off this. Mm. So I kind of wonder where it went to.
Well, I think part of the problem is volume. The Volt with the Bolt with a B,
which
the
is what EV, he was talking about.
Which what he was talking about. I mean, this thing looks like it's not going to sell anywhere near GM thought it was going to sell. I mean, this doesn't look too good. And so do you want to race in and spend hundreds of millions of dollars doing a variant of it when you probably are never going to get that money back? Even though I do agree with Jonathan, they should have made it look more like a CUV.
Yeah, hindsight's easy because I like it. I like driving. I think people that do it like driving it. So now we can say, well, they didn't make it sexy enough. But, Tesla Model 3 versus Bolt EV is this prime example of if people are excited about the car, like the electric powertrain isn't going to sell itself. And maybe that's what we're seeing with the Bolt EV is, it's electric and it has range and it's affordable, but people still want something that they get excited to see in the driveway.
All right, so I have a question, so everyone always talks about, the Tesla versus the Bolt. But why doesn't nobody ever say the Bolt versus the i3?
It's a good question.
I mean, so I think this
is the Bolt outselling the i3?
We can check.
I believe it is.
We can check on that. We can check on that. But but it's an interesting phenomenon that, here we have, the car from the purveyor of the ultimate driving machine that somehow gets just completely overlooked. Nobody even thinks about the i3. I mean, we had Sandy Monroe last week talking about the Bolt, and he had done that teardown of the i3 and said that the i3 is a technological marvel. And then when asked about, how does the Bolt compare to that? And he's like, not even close. And yet, here's a car that basically gets no attention or love at all.
Yeah. Look up the sales, and I'll add one other thing, too. Sandy contacted me after last week's show. One of the viewers, because remember, Sandy said, I would love to get my hands on a Tesla Model 3 and tear it down. One of our viewers contacted him and said, I'm in line. I got my deposit in. I'll happily sell you mine. And so Sandy then contacted me to say, hey, I need two. So anybody out there in Autoline After Hours land, Sandy Monroe, if you are going to get a Tesla Model 3, he would love to buy it off you because he wants two of them to tear down.
Why does he want two of them?
Well, my guess is he's going to want to have one torn down and then another one to be able to drive to understand better what they've ripped apart on the one they tore down.
You bring up a good point with the i3 because I like that and I forget about it. But it's another one where, we're always excited about things that are different or interesting looking. And the i3 is one of those cars where you go, but the i3, you kind of stop. It challenges people. And it's one of those examples where, personally, I think a lot of people say, why don't we have these cool designs? Why don't we have different designs? Everything looks the same. They bring something out that looks the same or looks different, and everyone sort of pulls back into that safe zone. It goes, that's a little too weird. But, again, like the Bolt EV, you get in it and drive it, and the seating position in that open cabin are amazing. But
see, but this is,
you got to be willing to open
your mind. This gets to the point of the importance of exterior design, because you've got to get somebody in it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because if they get stopped and it's like, holy crap, I'm not getting in that thing. So for the first six months of the year, Bolt sales, 7,592. And i3 sales, 2,992.
Wow. So the Bolt is outselling it 2-1, even though the Bolt is still not sold in all 50 states.
And one of the reasons for the comparison, I think, is that you're talking about 200-mile cars. That the i3 gets lumped into...
That's a good point.
A half a generation before.
What are they up to now, 125 miles?
Yeah, something like that.
For the i3.
For the i3, right. And that... So half the range, half the sales.
Yeah, and all the price.
That's right. Okay, Jay Siegel wrote in to say that, you heard us talking about maybe Ford buying Lucid, maybe, what he wants to know is, are the car companies shopping or being solicited by the EV developers? I think in the Lucid case, Lucid went to Ford and said, hey, you can buy us. But that's a good question. I don't know.
Well, I mean, okay, look at it this way. So what we're seeing, not about electric cars, but in terms of, developing autonomous technology. So this week, GM put an undisclosed investment in a company, Nauto, a Silicon Valley startup that's doing software for self-driving vehicles. Okay, and we saw them buy Cruise Automation. We saw Ford spend... money for that AI company,
Argus.
And so, while these guys are out in the valley kicking around, wouldn't it not be wise of them to say, hey, I think I'll go visit this company? And so maybe you're having a little bit of both, that the guys from Detroit are saying, hey, maybe we need to buy a full-blown company. And the full-blown companies are saying, hey, maybe they ought to sell this thing. I thought it was interesting. There was a quote I read from the Stefan Heck, founder and chief executive of two-year-old Nauto, said, quote, any vehicle manufacturer is better than any startup at building cars. I mean, isn't that a great admission that one of these guys in Silicon Valley would make, that those old bastards back in Detroit, those fossils, can actually do something better than Silicon Valley?
Well, that to me is the most interesting place to where this is going to play out, because a year or two ago, everyone was going to, Apple's going to make a car, Google's going to make a car, they're going to run Detroit out of business, and now it's not quite determined if they're going to be like a branded supplier, like a Brembo, or if they're going to be just a background supplier. And, and then they look at that and they go, some of these suppliers, that's a tough business to be in there as well. While the traditional suppliers are looking at that going, hey, we got to catch up. Or if they're going to, make something on their own and use suppliers to build it for them or partner with the OEM. So that to me is, how is it going to settle with Silicon Valley integrating with the automotive world?
Mm-hmm. So today was not a good day for Volkswagen again.
What happened?
So it seems that the state of California is looking for an additional $153.8 million.
Why?
Because they're saying that the 533 million, I'll say it one day, was insufficient, and so they need more. And it seems that this may happen.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So I did a little math. So if we take the two numbers, and I'm not going to say again because I'll screw them up, and you add those two numbers together, you get to $686.8 million. Volkswagen sold 85,000 cars in California. This means $8,080 per car they're going to be nicked for.
Wow. If I were Volkswagen, I might take the state to court over this. Of course, I don't know any of the background, so I shouldn't say, but for them to have reached a settlement and now come back later and go, hey, we want $100 million plus more.
So this is quoting from CARB's, today's additional consent decree was negotiated by attorneys and technical experts from CARB and the California Attorney General's office and is subject to court approval.
To me, it brings up the question, okay, where do you stop?
Yeah.
And not to minimize, okay, this has an environmental impact. You can associate a cost with that, and there is some punitive things you want to make sure so no automakers try something like this again. But, you know, you could just keep saying over and over, well, we need a little more.
Sounds like piling on. I'll have to get all the details, but at first blush, I'm kind of siding with Volkswagen on this one for the first time on this issue.
The number that astonished me is the fact that Volkswagen is paying $86 million to the California Attorney General's office for civil penalties and costs. I mean, isn't that nice?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like any lawsuit, the lawyers are the ones that get the most money. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, so speaking of other automakers, I mean, we saw this week that Mercedes is making a big recall in Europe of diesel engines. And I thought it was interesting is that in Zetsche's comments about doing this is that he wanted to, you know, help improve the confidence among consumers in diesel cars. I'm thinking, wait a minute, if I owned a diesel car and then I got a recall notice for the diesel car, how am I going to be confident in the diesel car, right?
Well, look, that's PR spin. You know, they're under investigation from the EU from cheating on diesel emission standards, and they're trying to get out ahead of this issue by going, oh, whoa, no problem, we'll recall them all and fix them. And, of course, up to now, they've been denying that they did anything wrong and that there was no problem with those cars. So, you know, a lot of times, you know, attorneys general can look more benignly on a company that shows remorse and shows remediation than one that's dragging its heels. And that's how I see this, is Mercedes trying to get out ahead of this before they get fined with some whopping big number.
So with that, I mean, whether it's in Europe or here, does diesel have any future existence?
I think no, just because of public sentiment. I mean, Europe is pivoting away from it super fast. Volkswagen has completely wiped it from their future passenger car plan. And you look at the way the EPA operates, where they announce an investigation very publicly with great fanfare before the, you know, before the findings have been, you know, fully finished. And that alone, you know, when you look at the FCA deal with diesel, is like, all of a sudden, you know, it just looks like, oh, FCA cheated too. You know, here's another diesel. It's just piling on. Diesel's bad, diesel's bad, diesel's bad. Even if it comes out a little bit better than what the initial, you know, assumption might be, that's just, I don't think it can come back from all the bad press.
What do you think?
I think diesel
will... Plus the technical challenges.
Diesels will survive in trucks.
So, you know,
when it comes to towing, definitely. When it comes to highway driving, they're still hard to beat.
Okay, so... light-duty passenger vehicle trucks or Class 8 over-the-road?
Oh, even light-duty passenger vehicles, passenger trucks, you know, full-size trucks, full-size SUVs, diesels still make a lot of sense in them. When you get into small cars, not so much because, you know, even though you can have a nice number, small cars already get better fuel economy even with a gasoline engine. So the cost and the benefit you get from that, not as impressive.
See, the thing I wonder about is you know, as Mike was saying, that, you know, diesel's name has been besmirched probably indelibly. I mean, that you can't polish that. It isn't going to go away, right? And so would there be a sufficient number of people who would buy a full-size SUV with a diesel or, you know, a light duty pickup truck with a diesel that would make it economical for the OEM to sell?
I do believe so, because these things are expensive. It's amazing what people will pay for a diesel. And remember, right now, Dodge Ram pickup truck, almost 30% of sales are diesels. So that's a pretty big number. And when you look at...
But isn't that one of the diesels they were nicked on?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I don't remember. I think they might have... No, it was nicked on, but I think it's been...
Well, they've just gone back to selling them. They just got certification for the current model year, so they're back in. There was a period there for a month or two where you could not buy them. They were not with the new stuff. They were not certified. But if you look at Chevy or Ford, especially with their medium-duty pickup trucks, you know, the F-250s, F-350s, that class, diesel does pretty well there. And like I said, I want to say they charge like $6,000 for those engines. I mean, they're making money on it.
Mm-hmm. But in those cases, though, I think you're looking at niche and special use, right? So pickup truck, you're getting advantage with a diesel, and there's a certain amount of like, yeah, I want the diesel. In passenger cars, you know, Volkswagen was selling, what, like 5,000, 7,500 a year. You know, Jaguar has it in there in the XE, and that's a really small volume. So you're saying, okay, well, this is an alternative, and you're courting that buyer that says, I want something special. But overall, we're not talking a lot of volume here. And speaking to the technical challenge, you got gasoline, all these extra costs for aftermarket, after treatment. Mm-hmm. And even as a consumer, you go, well, wait a minute, I'm going to get, you know, the gap is smaller where, unless it's something where you're getting all this extra torque or you're getting a significant mileage improvement. So in passenger cars, that's where it's the challenge. Like John was saying, you know, you look at the price and you go, I don't know if it's worth it.
Mm-hmm. But what I don't get to is the industry is just laying down and letting itself get run over in this debate because, you know, in the U.S., diesel engines have to meet the exact same emission standards as gasoline engines. So in Europe, they're in a big tizzy because all this talk about how diesels pollute more. In the U.S., they meet the exact same standards. Why isn't Europe just saying, or why aren't automakers who make diesels in Europe saying, we got to tighten up the standards and make them equal to gasoline engines because, and make this argument go away?
Okay, but wouldn't the point be, well, you know, we have to invest this money on developing electric vehicles or hydrogen vehicles or other alternatives, and so why should we be investing a ton of money in... Now, Mercedes says that they've spent like $3 billion on developing a new family of diesels that meet all the regulations. And,
right.
You know, but I just look at that and say, okay, is that a stopgap measure between, you know, now and, you know, 2030 when chances are, you know, combustion of any sort is going to be looked at askance, especially in Europe.
But Gary, they're already doing it. Mercedes and Volkswagen and BMW and Porsche all had to develop diesels that meet the U.S. emission standards.
Right.
So they've already done it. They've already done all the engineering. And in fact, if you said, okay, let's just put this on all our engines in Europe as well, yes, it would add cost, but now you could amortize that cost over millions of engines and bring the cost for each individual down a bit.
Except everybody says, I want an i3, I want a Mission E, I want, you know, I mean, it's...
Well if you look 20 years, you know, so, okay, an engine family might last 20 years, and you look 20 years down the road and you go, okay, some higher mix of cars we sell is going to be electrified. Engines are getting smaller. We're getting a bigger portion of, even in a hybrid, you know, you're switching from the electric part being bigger. You're not going to say, okay, for the next 20 years, we're going to put all our money into two different engine technologies. You're going to pick. And, you know, to me, it makes more sense. I'm guessing the automakers are going, all right, well, we're going to let the diesel you know, evolution chart sort of trail off.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, I agree. They're definitely putting their money into electric. No question about it. Hey, look, we've used up an hour here. Boy, it goes by fast. But Mike Austin, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Glad to be back.
Great having you on here, too. And Gary, let's keep on doing it.
Let's do it next week.
Well, we can do. Can do. And, of course, as always, want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.